We have two more cases on the docket, and so the first of the two is Williams v. Borrego, 20-1146, and we'll hear from the appellant.
Good afternoon to Judges McHugh and Bacharach, and good morning still, I think, for a little bit to Judge Abell. I'm Josh Urquhart on behalf of the DOC defendants appellants, and may it please the court. We're here today in front of this court for one key reason. The trial court below committed clear error when it held that a single unpublished 10th Circuit decision is sufficient to render an alleged constitutional violation clearly established for the purposes of the qualified immunity analysis. And it's clear error because there's an overwhelming weight of 10th Circuit authority that holds that while a single unpublished opinion can be helpful in showing that a constitutional violation is not clearly established, it's of little or no value in showing that it is clearly established. And I don't think the plaintiff really would disagree with that. Now, to be sure, in his answer brief, the plaintiff raises a new argument that there are other published 10th Circuit decisions and in decisions from other circuits that would suggest that this is a clearly established violation, and we disagree, and I imagine we'll spend some time.
Well, he raised many of those same cases in the district court, and for reasons beyond the defendant's, Mr. Williams' control, the district court chose to cite only one unpublished case. So, I mean, it seems a little bit unfair to chastise the Mr. Williams when he, in fact, did cite Yellow Bear, for example. So I don't really think this is a case where we're limited to one unpublished 10th Circuit case.
No, Your Honor, not obviously, as the plaintiff argues in his brief, the court can affirm on any grounds clear in the record. So it's absolutely within the court's discretion to say, although the trial court judge only relied on one unpublished opinion, that we agree with the plaintiff, that there are sufficient published opinions from the 10th Circuit or otherwise. And I'm happy to have that discussion. I think that this case, the decisions cited by the plaintiff at the appellate level are distinguishable, that they're not sufficiently similar to the facts alleged in this complaint to really satisfy the clearly established requirement.
Before we go there, I want to first look at jurisdiction because it's been challenged here. And it's challenged primarily because of the way your brief deals with the factual findings of the district court, which is, you know, to be generous to you, you take inferences from them that are supportive of you rather than Mr. Williams. And so, you know, for us to have jurisdiction, we have to be certain that you are willing to stand by all of the factual findings of the district court, but you say you prevail anyway, being bound by those facts. Is that where we are?
I think so, Your Honor. And without specific facts, I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but I think that's generally correct, yes.
Well, I mean, you argued that he only missed, you know, I think one service. You make some arguments from the factual findings that are not part of the factual findings. And I think that Mr. Williams has every right to have some concern about that, respecting our jurisdiction. But I think we can fix that if we can nail down that you understand you've got to win based on the facts found by the district court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. One thing on the one service, that is speculation. I do think the fact that prison regulations indicate that these are weekly services, I do think that the court can take judicial notice of that because it's a published regulation. I also think that the fact that...
So any Native American services are only available once a week, or a particular type of Native American services?
Your Honor, the list of services and what's allowed is voluminous in the DOC regulations. I will say that the sweat lodge services are offered on a weekly basis. And in addition to taking just judicial notice, I also think it's relevant that Mr. Williams cites the same regulation multiple times in his complaint. Page 25, if I recall correctly, has multiple citations to AR 800-01. So I think that he's incorporated it even in addition to being able to take judicial notice.
Did the complaint, now you keep saying and did in your brief that it was 1 week. It's actually not what the complaint said, right? It was
agreed, Your Honor. In reviewing in preparation for the argument, I think that the most the complaint can be interpreted to say is that it's some subset of the 30-day restriction period.
Well, why? I'm not even sure that it's a subset of the 30 days, because there is the start date when there was a ban on any religious exercises. And then there's no end date.
He does allege that.
All we really know from the complaint is that it was really more than 9 days.
Yeah, it was at least 9 days. It was at least the 4th to the 13th. That's absolutely accurate. He does allege that he was told it was going to be a 30-day restriction period. And I think it's probably reasonable to infer from that it was a 30-day period. And obviously, once the restrictions are lifted, then the restriction on tobacco has to be lifted, or the ban has to be lifted, because the services would be going on at that point.
So maybe to clarify what you were saying to Judge McHugh, it's really not one, you know, even if we judicially notice the sweat lodge availability once a week, so it's actually 4 that he would have missed, right?
It's at least 1 if it's the 9-day period, and it could be as many as 4 or 5, depending on how the days fall out in the 30-day period.
And we know from the case involving Ramadan that a 30-day ban on that coincides with Ramadan would be a substantial burden under the First Amendment, right?
We do, Your Honor, and that's the Macon case, and I agree, that is the most similar case, and from my point of view, the most problematic for my clients. But I still think that's eminently distinguishable for multiple reasons. First of all, as we point out in the brief, Ramadan is the highest holiday in the Muslim faith.
Just a sweat lodge. So let me ask you a hypothetical. What if it was a Jewish person like myself and it was Sukkot? And
I'm actually not familiar with what that service is. And if it's, okay, say, Passover or a similar high holiday in Judaism.
Let's take Passover. So if you miss, 8 days and it's Passover, is that a big enough deal to be similar to Ramadan?
Well, I think there's cases on point that suggest that it is. There are a number of cases that deal with Passover restrictions. I forget the name of the one, but...
What about if you're a Hindu and it's Diwali, the festival of light?
Assuming that's a high holiday, I would agree that puts it more along the lines of Macon. I should also say, though, that in addition to the high holiday aspect of it, there are a number of other distinctions. Ramadan is something that in Macon, the Macon case was impacted twice a day when he wasn't provided food before sunrise or after sunset. That, you know, just doing the math, that means 60 separate interferences with the practice of his religion. Also, if you read Macon, I think the Tenth Circuit in that case, it was really concerned with that there didn't seem to be any legitimate penological interest in the interference with the observance of Ramadan, except the prison argued apparently that they do it because it motivates people to stay out of solitary confinement. That was the penological interest. And then the Tenth Circuit didn't really think that was enough. Here, on the other hand, it's entirely different in that, based on Mr. Williams' own allegations, he alleges that contraband tobacco was found in inmate cells and that he was told that that's why the restrictions were put into place. So based on the alleged facts in the complaint, there is a legitimate penological interest here, at least arguably, that wasn't present in Macon.
Let me ask you this. You say you focus on the fact that, you know, we have a case where it was Ramadan and somehow this is different. But in McKinley, the Baptist services that he was prevented from attending for, I think it was a month, there's no suggestion that it was Christmas season or Easter season or, you know, Pentecost or something. It appears to be just normal services.
Correct, Your Honor. And frankly, if McKinley had been a published decision, I'm not sure we would be here. But it's not published. And the 10th Circuit Authority says that unpublished decisions aren't enough in and of themselves to make render the law clearly established.
But do you really think that you can interfere without a significant penological inference if it's just my weekly mass attendance as opposed to Easter services? I mean, I just don't see anything in the Supreme Court authority that would say that's perfectly fine.
Your Honor, I think you raise a good point, though, that there is an alleged penological interest. There is a penological interest as alleged in the complaint. There was contraband tobacco, according to Mr. Williams, contraband tobacco found in the prison. So to answer your question, I think with mass services, it would probably depend on the circumstances. If there's one that's been canceled, that might be a de minimis. If there's many, then it wouldn't be. But that hypothetical is just different than what we have here, because there is, in fact, a legitimate penological interest, at least arguably, based on the allegations in the complaint.
Let me ask about that for a second. Was there evidence of a penological interest? That is kind of a defense that the prison has to raise once it's otherwise been found to have violated a constitutional right. They're saying, well, there's a penological interest. And usually you get testimony and judges make findings on that. Do we have that kind of a record here, or are you simply extrapolating from the record that we should just say, well, of course there's a penological interest?
No, Your Honor, I'm it's at the dismissal stage, so there is no evidentiary record.
Right.
I'm relying solely.
I don't know how that affirmative defense of a legitimate penological interest, which prisons assert as a defense, even if it would otherwise be a violation, can factor in here, because I don't think we've got the record or the prison's evidence asserting that, do we?
Your Honor, I think that it would be a reasonable inference from his allegation that contraband tobacco was found, and he was told that was linked to the restrictions on sweat lodge ceremonies. I do think, though, that we're now getting really down into sort of the first prong of the qualified immunity analysis, whether this is in fact a constitutional violation. I think that we're here on the second prong, whether it's clearly established, whether even if everything he alleges is true, whether there is sufficiently similar authority that places this in, again, into the realm of clearly established.
Let's just be very clear, because what you just said is exactly what I thought this case presented. This case is not presenting facts or conclusions or evidence of penological interest or whether anything else other than whether clearly established law can be met by a single unpublished opinion, or whether it can be satisfied by additional cases that may have been cited by the district court or discovered by the 10th Circuit on appeal. That's the only question we really have to address.
That's my view too, Your Honor. I do think that the penological interest does play a role in the sense that it distinguishes this case for the purposes of the clearly established analysis from other cases. For example, McKinley, if McKinley had been a published one where there isn't any indication in the record, but that's the extent of it. That's the reason, the only reason it plays any role. And with that, I'd like to reserve a minute 30 if that's okay with the court.
Well, Kevin, let's stop the clock. For the appellant's counsel. And I do have one question, and I wasn't trying to interrogate you on about all these religious holidays, but there lies my the question I want to ask you to follow up on Judge McHugh's. If 30 days, viewing the allegations in the light most favorable to the plaintiff at this stage, would be sufficient if it were Ramadan, because Ramadan is such a major holiday for that faith, how do we draw the line and say, well, 30 days for sweat lodges is not so central to a Native American's faith as is Ramadan or Sukkot or Passover is or isn't, or Diwali is or isn't? isn't your line drawing for the prong two of qualified immunity going to force us as a court to decide the centrality, the significance of an infinite variety of faiths for the importance of each holiday?
Your Honor, I think that really raises two points. And the first is just the fact that there isn't a line, I think really supports our clearly established argument in this case. If there's no line, then how could a public official be put on fair notice that he's risking being held personally liable for a potential constitutional violation? If, again, there's no line to tell him one way or the other. The second thing that I would say is that at the dismissal stage, I think the claim is in the hands of the plaintiff. If the plaintiff wants to allege that the services that are being restricted or interfered with are especially important because they're a high holiday, because they're his favorite holiday, because, you know, for whatever reason, then I think he can do that. And that would put, again, at the dismissal stage, facts in the complaint that would allow you to make the comparison between Sweat Lodge services and Ramadan or Passover or Christmas or Easter or whatever the holiday you care for. So I think that's my answer. And then that's really the reason that is a distinction here, is because there simply is no allegation in the complaint that, you know, these services were of heightened importance or heightened value is probably a bad word, but heightened importance versus, you know, Ramadan or Passover. I mean,
why isn't Yellow Bear directly on point? It's Sweat Lodge services. There's no indication in the case that they have to be of particular religious significance. All it says is that a prison policy that prevents the plaintiff from participating in an activity motivated by a sincerely held religious belief constitutes substantial burden on his free exercise. I mean, directly on point.
I would disagree respectfully, Your Honor. I think that Yellow Bear is distinguishable in two different ways. The first way is that the prohibition on the Sweat Lodge services for, I believe, inmates in restrictive housing in Yellow Bear was permanent and indefinite. There was no 30-day limit put on it. So I think that in and of itself distinguishes it from the case we have here. The second way it is distinguished, again, in Yellow Bear, it was a permanent or indefinite. It was a prohibition altogether. And in our case, there was a period of time, and again, it's not entirely clear from the complaint, but it's some subdivision of the 30 days. But the remainder of that time, the services were allowed to continue. The inmates weren't allowed to use tobacco in them.
Well, and doesn't Yellow Bear also talk about objects preventing them from having access to the objects of their faith?
I don't recall that language from Yellow Bear, Your Honor.
And the tobacco ban, was that indefinite? It was, wasn't it?
It was a 30 day, as alleged in the complaint, I should say. Again, we're at the dismissal stage, so we have to take the allegations as they are in the complaint. As alleged in the complaint, Mr. Williams was told it was a 30 day prohibition on the use of tobacco.
Okay, Judge McHugh, did you have any questions?
No.
Judge Abell?
No.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. My name is David Fetter, and I represent appellee Charles Williams. The district court did not err when it held that it was a substantial burden on Williams. It was clearly established there was a substantial burden on Williams' religious exercise when it completely prohibited the use of tobacco in Native American religious ceremonies for 30 days. And prohibited all Native American ceremonies, pipe ceremonies, sweat lodge ceremonies, and other Native American ceremonies for more than 7 days. Take the tobacco claim first. This is a complete prohibition on religiously motivated conduct or an item used for religious practice. It is not a time, place, and manner restriction. It is not the limit on the amount of tobacco that can be used. As a Bull Deceive and Yellow Bear and made clear, that is easily a substantial burden on a plaintiff's religious practice.
What's your best case for the tobacco ban?
For 30, Your Honor,
30 probably, day tobacco ban.
I would say a Bull Deceive is probably the best case. Bull Deceive found that the denial of halal food for one feast of the sacrifice, was a substantial burden, as well as just during any time periods in which halal meals would not be available, when it wasn't far less than 30 days. the 30-day limitation is not articulated in case law. The rule is, if it's a complete prohibition, it's a substantial burden unless it's de minimis. So Majin as well involved a 30-day prohibition. And defendants try and distinguish Majin because they say Ramadan is just so much more important than the religious practice here. But again, that line does not come in the case law. This court has found numerous denials or prohibitions on religious practice with substantial burdens when they don't involve Ramadan. Abu Dhabi, for example, denial of halal meals for the Feast of the Sacrifice was a substantial burden, as well as any time periods in which halal meals would not be available. K.D. Bemis held the denial of care cards was a substantial burden, did not involve Ramadan, didn't involve any holiday at all. Holt v. Hobbs, same thing, denial of prohibition on growing a beard was held to be a substantial burden. And this court and the Supreme Court made clear, as Judge Baccarat was getting at, this court can't be in the business of drawing the lines of what religious practice is important or central. As Yellow Bear says, you can take the plaintiff as you find him, and you can't interpret how important the religious practice is to him. There's no requirement that it be central. All he has to show is sincerely held, and no one disputes this prohibition on sincerely held religious conduct. And if I could just backtrack for a quick second, there was a lot of talk about legitimate penological interests. I would just like to clarify that is not an issue in this appeal. The only thing that is issue in this appeal is whether there was a substantial burden. The district court never reached the question of whether there was legitimate interest or how the Turner v. Safley balancing might shake out. The defendants didn't argue about it below or in the briefing here, so this court should not consider it. You know, the cases that are finding de minimis prohibitions on religious conduct are just far shorter time periods in here. In Gallagher, three meals over about 10 months, that's about 3 out of 900 meals, was found to be a substantial burden, none closer than a month apart. And a one-time negligent prohibition or failure to properly clean kosher utensils was also found to be a substantial burden. In a bowl to see, a one-time negligent putting of non-halal pudding and non-halal jello on a tray with halal food, negligent done, was found to be a substantial burden. And if I can just add, as Ralston and Gallagher make clear, any conscious or intentional prohibition on religious conduct is a substantial burden, regardless of how long it takes, how long it occurs, whether it's relatively brief or not. And it's more than plausible here that this was a conscious or even intentional prohibition on both the tobacco claim and the services claim. On the tobacco claim,
you made this point in your briefs about it should be a different rule for a conscious restriction versus a unconscious restriction. I don't know how you would ever get an unconscious restriction, hardly. It seems to me that you're basically saying that we should throw out de minimis, and if there's a decision by the prison to restrict a religious practice, not because they're opposed to the religion, but for some prison reason, but if as long as it's conscious restriction, that they know they're restricting religious practice, that's the end of the story.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I'll give you an example. In a Abu Dhabi, you know, there was non-halal pudding and jello placed on the tray. You know, who knows how it happened? Maybe that was just they mixed up the trays negligently. So I think there's still room for the negligent prong to do a fair amount of work. But the de minimis exception is very limited. As K.D. Bemis says, sincerity, not the importance, not the duration, not anything else, is the key component to establishing a substantial burden. If I can just return for a moment to the question of intent, Williams alleged in his complaint that these are required Native American practices. His faith requires it. So there's no reason to think that it's any less important than Ramadan. Indeed, defendants concede that this is as important to Williams as the religious practice was in Ramadan. But he also alleged that the tobacco ban was just 30 days flat out at the beginning of them finding contraband tobacco. And he further alleged that the person who was caught with the tobacco had never been in Native American ceremonies. He never met the person who was caught with the tobacco, and that the tobacco did not come from the Native American ceremonies. At this stage in the case, pro se inmate complaint construed liberally with all reasonable inferences drawn in his favor. That's more than enough. It's more than plausible. This is a conscious or even intentional prohibition on religious practice. And same on the services claim. He alleges that although other faith areas might have supervised observers, the Native American faith area is secured to a far greater degree than any other faith area. So again, with the liberal presumptions afforded him, that's more than plausibly conscious or intentional. So this court doesn't even have to get into isolated if it does not want to. The plaintiffs returned to the isolated prong and returned to, sorry, did you have a question, Judge?
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Fader, but how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that, and I'll put it a somewhat different way, that qualified immunity protects all but the plainly incompetent, and you have an argument that, okay, well, Gallagher versus Shelton specifies that only if it's not conscious, only if it's not isolated, and you have on the one hand, and then you have on the other hand, the other polar opposite is, well, if you have 30 days and a faith that it's the critical part of that faith, Ramadan, we know that that's unconstitutional. And here in the middle somewhere are the two species of free exercise violations that are alleged here for at least 9 days or more. There's a ban on any religious exercise in 30 days for use of one specific commodity, tobacco, and that, well, you know, these prison officials aren't of the legal caliber that you are. They're not lawyers. They're not, it's not someone who is not plainly incompetent might not realize that the line should be drawn to say that if it's 9 or more days, it's treated like Ramadan, the deprivation of Ramadan. So how do you respond to that argument?
My first point I would make, Your Honor, is that Abul Tasib said that denial of food for one meal is a substantial burden, as well as any time periods in which all meals will not be available. So you don't even have to get into this more complex line drawing. But if I could just talk about the standard for qualified immunity, which I think Your Honor is getting at. The standard for qualified immunity, as defendants made in the brief, is whether defendants were put on fair notice. And this court and the Supreme Court has made clear that that doesn't mean you're scavenging your hunt for the perfect puzzle piece of the exact same facts. It does not have to be the exact same facts. It just has to put defendants on fair notice. And I would submit the cases here put defendants on fair notice. Another point about the standard is a lot of times qualified immunity comes up in the Fourth Amendment context where we're dealing with really vague legal rules like excessive force, unreasonable searches and seizures, et cetera. So it makes sense why this court has sometimes been requiring a more directly, exactly factually on point case in order to provide fair notice. Here we're dealing with a very straightforward legal rule. Complete prohibition on religious practice or conduct motivated by religious faith is a substantial burden, unless it's de minimis, meaning both isolated and negligent. There's neither isolated nor negligent here. So I think defendants were on more than fair notice. I think the level of generality here is completely fair and akin to Casey v. Sitter of Federal Heights, where this court relied on two lines of cases and two legal principles. Violent force is least justified and is a nonviolent misdemeanant was one of the principles. And the other principle was an officer has a duty to mitigate use of excessive force by other officers. If those are the sort of rules which should clearly establish the law, which it did in Casey, then I submit it would clearly establish the law here too. And Yellow Bear, I know there's some discussion about whether Yellow Bear talked about products. Yellow Bear says the sacramental use of food and wine is necessary for religious practice. So I just wanted to flag that. And we also have Weber, which also involved a tobacco ban, and the court said that was, or sorry, the Eighth Circuit said that was a substantial burden. If I could talk maybe a little bit more about me.
In looking at your clearly established law, does it matter that Yellow Bear was a ban for an indefinite period of time? And here we've got a 30-day ban?
No, Your Honor, the case law does not talk about any indefinite prohibition being required. To the contrary, it's almost the opposite.
Well, I'm not saying whether it's required. I'm saying, is it clearly established? The fact that Yellow Bear held that indefinite suspension of the sweat lodge services was a substantial burden, should that have put him on notice that a 30-day restriction was also?
Perhaps not Yellow Bear alone, but Yellow Bear, in light of the other case law, put defendants on fair notice because there's no requirement or no articulation in the case law that has to be indefinite. And to the contrary, as I mentioned, Abul Tasib involved a far shorter duration. If I just make the point real fast that this should be conceived of as a flat 30-day ban on both the pipe ceremony and the sweat lodge ceremony. Because as Weaver, the Eighth Circuit case, makes clear, tobacco is fundamental to the use of both pipe ceremonies and sweat lodge ceremony. So I think even if you need the 30 days, like Macon, we're exactly on point there. And if I could just say, defendant's other attempts at submission to Bull Deceive and Macon are unavailing. They say a Bull Deceive involved RLUIPA, and this is a First Amendment free exercise context, but a Bull Deceive also makes clear that Congress intended the definition of substantial burden in RLUIPA to be interpreted consistently with substantial burden in the free exercise context. And it quotes a piece of legislative history which makes the exact same point and says it should be interpreted no more broadly in the RLUIPA context than in the First Amendment context. Coming at it from a more textualist perspective, it's the exact same words, substantial burden, in the exact same context of religious exercise. And defendants have cited no case which would suggest that there's any daylight between the two. And I'm not aware of any.
Let me see if I'm stating your position correctly, which is that the defendant should have been on notice that any non-de minimis interference with exercise of their sincerely held beliefs was clearly established.
At least when it comes to a complete prohibition on items used in religious conduct or the services themselves, yes, that is the rule the case law articulates. And this court has in numerous unpublished cases relied on RLUIPA cases to determine a substantial burden in the First Amendment context. They also try and draw an act omission distinction between the food cases and this case, but the case law does not have any act omission distinction. Yellow Bear and Bull Deceive clearly lay out as separate equal ways of being a substantial burden, requiring conduct that's prohibited by religious faith or prohibiting conduct that's required by religious faith. Indeed, numerous prohibition cases have found substantial burdens. K.V. Bemis, prohibition on tarot cards, Yellow Bear, prohibition on sweat lodge, Wolfie Hobbs, prohibition on growing a beard. They say that Macon is different because, in that language from Bull Deceive, if you trace it back to Beer High, which is quoting, it's talking about the Turner v. Safley balancing for whether a prison's action is reasonably related to a legitimate penological interest, which is not an issue here. So that language doesn't apply for another reason. And that language, all it says is when there's one of several ways of accomplishing a religious belief, leaving alternative avenues open is not as bad as requiring conduct that's prohibited by religious faith. But that language just doesn't apply to this case because Williams alleges that he's required to engage in pipe ceremonies and sweat lodge ceremonies, and there's no suggestion that he might be able to engage in some alternative religious practice. In Macon, they emphasize that it was an important annual holiday, but again, Bull Deceive and other cases show there's no requirement for being an annual holiday or a super important holiday, and that would require this court to get down line drawing that it prohibited in cases like Yellow Bear, K.V. Bemis, Employment Division v. Smith, and Hernandez v. Commissioner. In the words of the Supreme Court, trying to draw distinctions between the importance of religious practices is just outside the judicial ken. So that can't be a distinction between Ramadan and these other cases. It would also... different adherents are entitled to understand different religious practices differently. And so there's no way to even do a categorical determination on the importance of Ramadan or some of the other holidays, Sukkot, et cetera. And it would also pose favoritism to religions which have greater number of high holidays, as opposed to religions which are equally important, but might to the adherents, but might not have so many annual holidays. That's something that Yellow Bear, K.V. Bemis, Supreme Court case law makes clear is prohibited. And I see I'm over my time. So unless, anyone has further questions?
Judge Abell, do you have any questions?
No.
Judge McHugh?
No.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. And I believe the appellant has a little bit of time, a minute 28 for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I wanted to address really one sort of overarching thing that was raised by counsel's argument. And he kept on emphasizing that we have no authority that says a 30-day ban or a 30-day restriction is different than an indefinite permanent. And I think that kind of turns the burden of proof for qualified immunity and the clearly established prong on its head. It's not really our responsibility to show that there isn't, the cases are too dissimilar. It's their burden to show that there is a similar enough case, again, so a defendant would be put on fair notice that he could be personally liable for potential constitutional violations. And in that regard, what I would just say is that there's really two points to make. First, in the, I believe it's Ali v. Du Bois case, the Tenth Circuit has made clear that for First Amendment cases, free exercise cases, that there is a higher degree of similarity required than simply there's a burden on the exercise in this case, so therefore it necessarily must apply to the other case, regardless of how similar the facts are. And I think that's consistent with the authority from this circuit, which at least for a long time, it used sort of a sliding scale, where the more egregious the violation, the less similar the cases needed to be. As Judge Bacharach noted in Lowe a while back, a couple years ago, I think, there's some question as to whether and how that's been modified by the Supreme Court. But I think the underlying principle is sound, and that is just that if we're talking about egregious violations, physical harm, the bodily harm, then I think the level of similarity really is less than cases like this, where this is not an outrageous or egregious type of conduct. It was restricting tobacco when it was found as contraband in the prison. And with that, I'm over time, so I'll stop.
All right. Thank you. Judge Abell, do you have any questions?
No.
Judge McHugh?
No.
All right. Thank you, counsel. This matter is submitted.